black, just like the heart of the space program. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that's returned mysteriously from deep space. Now, let's be clear from the outset. This film is definitely not, for some very important legal reasons, called Godzilla vs. Kong. That's because the movie we're reviewing here is what's called a mockbuster, one of those not so thinly veiled, but just thinly veiled enough, rip-offs of a mega-budget blockbuster. So, after Godzilla vs. Kong stomped into cinemas, those masters of the cheap knockoff, The Asylum, quickly bashed out the film we're reviewing today, Ape vs. Monster. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who is synonymous with the second rate, the second hand, and the second tier. He's everyone's second choice podcast guest. It's Nick Rehack. Welcome back to the show, Nick.
Thank you very much for that glowing introduction, Will.
Oh, as always, I like to give you a warm glow whenever you're on the show. So, hopefully you're sort of now, you know, feeling, you know, you're charged with positivity for the next, you know, 30, 40 minutes.
I am very much so.
You're really responsible for the film that we are reviewing today, because a little while ago I got a very enthusiastic message from you saying, you were sending me the trailer for this movie, and you were saying, you know, there is no way this film does not have an exploding helicopter, and I want to be doing the review of this movie. So when I checked out the film, I found it had an exploding helicopter. So you were the person that I obviously immediately got in contact with to set up this review. So I mean, this movie, it's all down to you. So you must be absolutely psyched to be here and talking about this film.
I am. I put it on my dream board. I cut out a picture of the poster and I said, I will podcast about this film. I spoke it into the universe. I sent an email, and lo, here we are. I'm very excited. Also apologetic. But it's just I can't remember why I was on the internet just scrolling through something, and I saw a headline, and I'm like, there's no way. And I saw the trailer, and I'm like, I have to see this now. As big a Godzilla fan as I am, like, there's no way I'm not going to see this. And of course, you know, with the military involved, there has to be at least an exploding helicopter. I'm like, I know who will appreciate this.
Well, I mean, you feel a little bit bad about sort of making us both watch this movie. And I feel a little bit bad about this too, because, you know, I know that you're a really massive Godzilla fan, and I've been promising you for a while that we would do one of the films in that particular series to review on the podcast, because quite a lot of them feature an exploding helicopter. And, you know, here we are. And I mean, it's not a Godzilla film. This is about as close to a Godzilla film as you've gotten on the Exploding Helicopter podcast. And it's Ape versus Monster, not the real thing.
It's not, but it's like a warm up. You know what I mean? It's a precursor set in the same universe. It's we wink and nod, but we don't necessarily get into it. It's like the Conjuring films, but we're talking about Annabelle. But we're gonna get to the Conjuring.
Well, this is really us getting like match fit in order to take on a Godzilla movie. Is that what you're thinking?
Bingo.
Okay. On that attractive image, I think we'll leave this part of the show. So let's get stuck into Ape versus Monster. So let's roll the trailer.
Roger the grass line. 15 seconds.
I see it.
Do you hear that?
Holy hell.
He is 5 meters greater in length than when first captured.
The capsule was covered in it.
Do you believe it has something to do with Abraham's growth? How do we know that there weren't traces of that substance left on the desert floor?
We just had a report of an unidentified light pens moving really fast eastbound.
You have big problems.
Secure the area!
Abraham's escaped.
Where are the targets currently headed?
For Washington, D.C.
The Gila, it's about to emerge.
Abraham! Check his ass. The horror we're facing now will only just be the beginning.
This is war, gentlemen. Intergalactic combat.
Ah!
we've got a problem.
In the 1980s, America and Russia cook up a secret project to make contact with alien life. This involves the two superpowers launching a spaceship containing a monkey into deep space to look up ET. Now, 30-something years later, that capsule has mysteriously returned to Earth and crash-landed. Still on board is the cosmonautic chimp, only he appears to be growing larger at an alarming rate. Could it have something to do with the mysterious green goo that's all over the capsule, and the same green goo that's been sucked up by a passing Gila monster? Inevitably, the two creatures quickly grow to a fantastic size and, with an appreciation for cinematic convention, head for Washington, D.C. so that the White House can provide a picturesque backdrop for the climactic confrontation. Heading up the cast, we have the hardest working man in film and television, the one-time Oscar nominee, Eric Roberts, and alongside him, we have literally no one else. Most of the other actors here have next to no screen credits to their name. The director is Daniel Lusko, whose previous work is an odd blend of religious documentaries and rip-off cinema like this. 8 vs. Cinema came out this year in 2021. It has a 2.1 rating on IMDb and a 1.7 rating on Letterboxd. So, with all of that out of the way, Nick, what did you make of 8 vs. Monster?
I found it intriguing. I thought that there was a lot of really good groundwork laid in order to come up with something mysterious and exciting, but I feel like it didn't pay off. A lot of, you know, Godzilla films, there's always they focus more on the people drama and they just look at, you know, the monsters every so often to keep you in the seats and the action. I totally understand it. This set up for a really fun conspiracy, you know, US versus Russia, space aliens. There was so much going for it, and I feel like they just kind of gave up at the end and didn't stick the landing. And it was a little disappointing because there is a lot that could be done well here. This could this could have been a really, really well done movie, but they didn't go all the way, and I think that's what ends up hurting it in the long run.
I think that is a really good observation, because I actually completely agree, because this is an asylum movie. They have a pretty terrible reputation for making these types of movies, and it's not undeserved. But this one actually wasn't too bad. I mean, it's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination. But as you say, there is quite a lot of like ideas at play here within the film, and there does actually seem to actually be quite a lot of potential within those particular ideas, and you know, even within the limited budget that they're working with. But they just don't. Yeah, I completely agree with you. They just really don't make the most of them, and that's a bit of a frustration, because it does feel like, you know, potential has been wasted, and particularly for the point that you make, that a lot of those good ideas are about the human drama, so they don't require necessarily like a big budget to make it work. It just requires, you know, somebody to work the ideas through in the script.
Absolutely, and it does feel like a first draft script. It feels like as soon as they said, hey, Godzilla versus King Kong is coming, and they saw more and more, they're like, well, we got to do something just as similar. We're going to, you know, roll off of the same energy that they're bringing into this. But I feel like if you pivoted and focused on maybe two or three of the subplots instead of the four or five that are there and really hone in and hunker down, you'd have something really, really interesting. Maybe, you know, we lose the space aspect of it, and we just focus on, you know, the daughter father relationship, USA versus Russia, everything going on with like the space capsule. But there's also, and I mean, obviously there's plot holes, but there's a couple things that I wish they would have fleshed out to help make sense with some of the characters, because I think that would have added, I don't want to say grounding, but there's definitely some things where I'm like, okay, I don't know what this character is about, because they say this, but then they also say that, and the two kind of contradict each other. What exactly are we trying to accomplish? And I feel like if they would have just focused in, it would have been a stronger film than what it was.
Yeah, I am inclined to agree with you. And, you know, let's dig into some of the kind of plot strands that are at work here. So one of the kind of sort of central ideas of this movie is that basically in 1985, there was a joint mission between the Americans and the Russians in order to end the Cold War. Now, the idea of this film is that basically Bush Jr., which is confusing, and Putin, and remember this is meant to be 1985, basically cooked up this idea to do a joint mission into space to make contact with alien life. And the idea being that making contact with alien life would help end the Cold War and would be good for the economies of both of those countries. And, you know, that is I like the idea of some sort of secret American Soviet space mission, but the idea that somehow this would be about ending the Cold War, and that, you know, meeting ET would help end the Cold War and there'd be some sort of economic benefit to the countries, it really doesn't make sense.
No, it's rather bizarre, and it's this weird timeline thing that, again, Bush Jr. and Putin, it's like, okay, I don't know how those two would have interacted. I mean, at the time, if it's 85, what? Reagan is still in office. Yeah. Bush is running the CIA. So I can understand, you know, Bush and Putin kind of having
Bush
interactions.
Senior, but it would be
Bush Senior. But for Junior to come through, and that just – it becomes so bizarre. And then they're trying to tell you – basically what it is now, like the countries can come together for the purpose of war, but rather than war against each other, it's war against this unknown entity. So you're going to have a booming economy because everybody's going to be, you know, buying war bonds, or they're going to be buying, you know, just all kinds of stuff that anybody can sell left and right. And it's weird because at times too, this film kind of does like political digs like that. They talk about, you know, the industrial military complex, and they talk about, you know, they throw politicians in there every so often, and I'm like, all right, we get it. like they have an argument, and Eric Roberts, he's like, gentlemen, this is the Pentagon. Leave the fighting to Capitol Hill. It's like, what? It's like some kind of like Dr. Strangelove light type remark he's trying to make, and it's like, well, are you trying to be satirical or are you trying to be an action film? And there's weird tonal shifts in there too, and it all just gets lost, and I feel like they just bring it up every so often to remind you, like, well, this is why we're doing it. And it's like, yeah, if you have to keep telling us, then the reason's not strong enough. So
yeah, and it feels, as you say, I think going back to that remark you were making earlier, it feels like a first draft. It feels like they needed a couple more passes of the script here, and they probably could have done something that made a little bit more sense and something that actually was a little bit more interesting and played into the traditional classic sort of hostilities and mistrust that we all know and love between Americans and Russians that we've seen done so many times in movies. That's just one of the many plot strands that are at work in this particular film. And there's another one which ties into that in some way, which is, you know, we have leading the response to the threat once this capsule crash lands on Earth. We have these two scientists who are paired together in order to tackle the threat. One's Russian and one's American. They're both female, and it seems they've got a bit of history together. So we learn in the script that they studied together at university, and I mean, it's never explicitly stated, but I mean, reading between the lines, they're clearly sort of implying that they used to be lovers whilst they were at university. So we've got this sort of, they've got these two characters who, I guess they're sort of meant to be pitted against each other because they're from these two different countries. But they've got this sort of personal history together. But again, this film sort of sets it up, but it doesn't stick the landing.
It doesn't, because when we're first introduced to the characters, you have Dr. Linda Murphy. She's kind of sitting there shocked and dazed at what just happened to her and the squadron. And here you have Ava coming up, and she's like, Ava Kuleshov? Like she doesn't remember. They're not old. They're relatively young. If I had to guess, I'm going to say they're in their 30s.
Mm.
And if this is 2021, right?
Yep.
They would have been born in, 91 or anywhere between 85 and 91. We'll just say that.
Yep.
So if they're launching, Abraham, the name of the monkey. If they're launching Abraham into space in 85, how is Linda around for that to happen? And if they both went to university at Oxford together, I'm going to assume in their 20s, 10-year difference, you're going to remember somebody's face. It's not like they met in elementary school and they're trying to do a recall. It's all relatively recent. And like you said, there's such an implication of having a relationship of some sort, definitely more than friends, BFF or higher. Why act so surprised? And then there's this weird running joke where she'll quote something. She's like, what is that, Lennon? It's like, no, Star Trek. What is that, Star Trek? No, Lennon. And it's – I don't know. They have this weird on and off, will they, won't they, like chemistry at all times. And I found it so bizarre. And sometimes I would find myself thinking about it, get completely lost and have to rewind to see what I missed for the last 5 minutes, only to realize, yeah, I didn't miss much.
And again, you raise an interesting point or a kind of very relevant point again about the very confusing timeline in this movie, because there is yet another interesting sort of subplot to this movie, because for unexplained reasons, in order to make first contact with extraterrestrials, the Americans and Russians decide to put this monkey, this chimpanzee called Abraham, inside this space capsule. We never learn why that is or what they expect the chimpanzee to do when it finally catches up with ET. We never learn that, but the kind of, in terms of the confusing timeline, as you say, both of these women, they can't really be older than sort of mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
So born at the time that this capsule would have been launched. But one of the plot strands of this movie is that Abraham the chimpanzee, before he was launched into space in 1985, was sort of like a childhood friend, childhood pet of Dr. Linda. So she must actually be, well, if that's to be the case, she must have been at least 40, which just isn't it. I mean, she must have a really good skincare regime if she's 40.
Maybe it's Maybelline, because there's just no possible way. And it doesn't make sense, and it becomes baffling. And then they continue to confuse you because now they're throwing in space. Now, all of a sudden, her father's back in the picture. Now, all of a sudden, the CIA is kind of turning on her, and now all of a sudden Eva's speaking to the Russians about something secret, which I watched this with my wife and she pointed this out and I couldn't not think of it. When we see Ava speaking to her Russian, I guess, boss or higher up or government representative for the Russian government, when they're speaking back and forth, there's no subtitles there.
Mm.
And you would think, just a little something to make it sinister, like even if it's vague, to kind of make you think like, we should watch Eva. But there's not. They're just talking back and forth. And my wife's like, oh, they're just making up words and sounds. It's not really Russian they're speaking. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe you're right, because in any other film, there would be some kind of subtitle. There would be something letting us know. But again, it's closed off. It's, we don't know who this Ava person is outside of maybe at some point in her life she went to Oxford, met Linda, and they interacted in some way, shape, and form. And it's bizarre, and I don't understand why they wouldn't try to flesh it out a little bit, just something.
Well, the version I watched did actually have subtitles for those particular scenes. So you do
– really?
Yeah. So you do – I did – it was on – it was just on terrestrial TV here in the UK. So I recorded off that, and those scenes were subtitled. So, there was nothing in some ways, probably the fact there were no subtitles might have made it a little bit more of an interesting watch for you, because then there's a bit of an intrigue as to what those conversations were. Having watched them with subtitles, they are fairly blandly scripted scenes. So I'm not, you may actually have had the better experience with them.
Okay, because we watched it on Amazon and everything, for some reason, the subtitle was on and we couldn't get it off or whatever. So English subtitle, we figured out what they were saying. But then when it came to the Russian, it just – not even the film had the subtitles in there. You know? It was so bizarre to me.
Yeah. And then, as you made a reference to it there, then we have yet another plot strand, which is that, you know, Linda's father was the man who basically cooked up this particular kind of joint American-Soviet mission into space. And Linda kind of feels betrayed that her childhood monkey got sent off into space to go and meet E.T. And, you know, that seems to have been created some sort of schism between her and her dad, which is now plays out in the film because, you know, we hear her say, oh, I haven't spoken to my father in 10 years. And she's, you know, the Eric Roberts, who's sort of in charge of this operation, tackling this threat. He wants to bring her father back in to kind of like help try and sort out this mess. But, you know, she's against it because of the enmity that she still feels. So, again, yeah, we have this other dynamic at play here with Linda and her daddy issues.
And then nothing really comes of it other than them just repeating the idea and the notion that he just wasn't there. He wasn't around. How could he do this? He wasn't there. He wasn't around. And then there's this weird maybe she's adopted thing. At the very end, he talks about like something like of my blood or something just very one off and thrown out. It's like, wait, was she adopted? Like, is there an even deeper thing behind it of like, you know, like a double abandonment thing? They just keep throwing it in there. I guess they're thinking like, oh, and then they're going to feel, you know, emotions because of this. And it's like, not really, dude. We don't know the relationships here.
And then we probably should also mention the final plot strand that is thrown into the mix in this potpourri of pot-boiling plot action, which is the idea that these creatures are this Gila monster and this chimpanzee sort of grow to this enormous size because they've eaten this sort of green goo which was brought back into Earth on this capsule. But then there's this whole sort of plot strand that actually, I'm not even sure if I can really explain, I'm not even sure if the film explains it, but I guess eating this green goo sets up some sort of psychic or radio transmission link with an alien species who are now then able to control these creatures on Earth. And so the idea is that these aliens are controlling these two creatures as they rampage about on Earth. And I really didn't know what on Earth they were trying to do with that particular plot strand. I mean, it really didn't need it. They just needed the green goo. They grow to a big size. They start fighting. You know, the idea that they're being controlled by aliens, we really didn't need that in this film.
No, it makes it muddy and more confusing because they say that these life forms are from the Andromeda Galaxy. And, well, I don't know if you know anything about the Andromeda Galaxy.
I can't say
it is. 2.5 million light years away. Do you know how many miles are in a light year, roughly?
No idea.
6 trillion miles. So take 2.5 million, multiply it by 6 trillion. How can anything control anything within like less than a second from such a far distance? I mean, granted, the alien, it's coming in. It's magically going to be in Earth in like a day. And it's just showing up and it's running stuff all of a sudden. We never see the creatures. We never know what type of creature. We never understand. They're just like, oh, here's this thing, and it's gone. It'd be no different than a cloud passing in the sky. And they make a big deal out of it for no reason.
Mm.
And why is it a goo? If there's such an advanced life form, it would make that much more sense if it was like these little – you know, machine bugs.
Yeah.
Like that kind of burrow into the skin or burrow into the back of the skull to the brain, and now you're under their control. That would make 1,000 times more sense. But to have this goo and to just like maybe get lucky, that's a very, very thin plot line. Like, hey, we just got lucky. Let's explain the goo. Or just something else. But I wholeheartedly agree with you. Drop the alien thing. There's this mysterious goo. We don't care. All we care is that it makes Abraham massive. It makes this random Gia monster massive. And now they're going to fight because of some weird, you know, alpha, I have to bravado kind of thing. Like, that's what we want to see. And have them fight anywhere. It doesn't have to be in DC of all places, because – well, I'm sure we'll talk about that when we get there, but it's just it and the way they travel, the paths they travel in this film don't make any sense to me whatsoever.
No. Yeah, because what the Gila monster, I think the idea is it sort of burrows underground, which really doesn't make any sense because it's truly massive by this stage. Mm-hmm. So the idea that it could the burrowing underground is a realistic option for it doesn't make sense, is not believable. I think the only reason it does means they do it is because it means that the Gila monster can be off screen and they don't have to they don't have to do any CGI work whilst it's burrowing underground.
Oh, they do plenty of hey look over off screen, because there are so many reaction shots of them just like looking in horror, and all we hear is sound effects and they're explaining what they're seeing. And after a while, I got kind of annoyed. I just show us something, anything, please. Like, and every time they cut back to Eric Roberts at the Pentagon or when they were at Langley, they showed the exact same footage of Langley every single time. You could set your watch to it. If there was a drinking game, it's like every time they show Langley, take a drink. But they really pulled back and away from the CGI as much as possible, and I think that hurts it as well.
Yeah, it's probably one of those sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't, because yeah. I guess the more you put of the CGI on screen, the more it shows up the limitations of mm-hmm. of the film. And you know, I guess every minute of CGI is just burning up what little budget they had of this movie. So I imagine it's purely for practical considerations. But let's talk about the CGI and I guess the, you know, the kind of the monster action that we get in this movie, because, you know, that's really what people want from things like Godzilla versus Kong and all of these types of movies, is they want to see big monsters destroying cities, all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, did this film, you know, you're a Godzilla fan, did this film deliver on the type of kind of big brawling smash 'em up action that you want from a film like this?
Oh no. Oh no. This is the farthest thing. I think it would look better if they just had stick figures just pointing at each other and screaming. The Gia monster didn't look bad. For the few shots that it was in, granted, they were all very dark shots, so you didn't have to show a whole lot of it. Overall, it looked good. But Abraham, it was just a nightmare. It is truly, like, worse than a fever dream. It's just a nightmare-looking creature. It didn't even look like something out of the 90s. It looked like CGI from the 80s. When it would breathe in, its entire body would cave in and out in the weirdest possible ways. And it was just so off-putting. There's a scene where the Gia monster attacks this very small military group. I mean, in ridiculously small. I think they're like special forces or something. And this guy has a flamethrower, I think, and he's just trying to launch it. And the flames look terrible. Like, even the flame – like, I've seen flames in video games from the 80s look better.
Well, forget that. What about the flamethrower itself? It looks like it's something you would, you know, try and use to get rid of the green fly in your tomato plants. I mean, it doesn't look anything like a military-issue flamethrower.
It's absolutely bug spray. There's no way you're going to go to the military. Let me see your flamethrower. Oh, it's just this clear plastic tank with pink stuff floating around in there. No, that's not at all how it works. If I was creating this film and I was the director and the creative force behind it, I would have went old school. I would have went, we're going to put people in suits, we're going to build a model city, and we're going to have a whole lot of fun destroying it. Obviously, with it being 2021, you have a lot better prosthetics, you have a lot better designs you can do. That would have been, to me, really fun to see. You get really serious with the plot and the drama, and then we cut to, and it's just two people fighting each other dressed as a Gia monster and like a massive ape. Like, that would be really, to me, fun. And I think they would have made a lot. They could have done so much more creatively with the budget instead of what we got, which was incredibly off-putting.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand the cost cutting when it comes to the CGI, because I can imagine the expense that, you know, lies behind that kind of technology. But what I've actually found more inexplicable than the special effects in this movie was, in terms of the cheapness anyway, was actually more to do with the costumes and the props. So, for instance, at the beginning of this film, you know, we have this team of soldiers going out to the capsule that's just crash landed on Earth, and all of these soldiers are dressed in, you know, they don't have, you know, you would think they would have identical uniforms on, that they would
you
have.
You would think.
They would have, you know, they would have identical guns. You know, they would look like people who are employed by the same organization. But no, I mean, you have people in this sort of ragbag mismatch of like stuff that just seems to have been grabbed out of an army surplus store. Everyone seems to have brought, you know, whatever gun they've got at home along with them. And I just kind of was baffled that. Can you not find six army uniforms that look the same? I mean, how cheap is this film that you can't even afford to have six army uniforms that look roughly the same?
Even when you get to this, because I got two different thoughts at once here. Even when you get to the special forces scene that I alluded to, you have two guys that are the same, and everybody in the back is dressed completely different. It looks like the guys in the front are sporting Iraq war, Middle East conflict, and the guys in the back are sporting Vietnam era military uniforms. And then there's the scene where Linda's running around with some gear on, and the guy's like, you're wearing it wrong. And she's like, well, I like it this way. It's like they even knew. It's like they knew, like, yeah, this isn't great, but, you know, let's just go for it. They're not going to pay attention. I'm genuinely surprised someone just didn't have a broom handle and pretended it was a rifle.
I think that would have really have just fitted right in with the rest of the sort of the action that we get in this film, because, yeah, I mean, just in so many scenes, the sort of paucity of budget is sort of shown up. And I think it's really the army uniforms that the bit that I found the most offensive, because, as I say, I mean, how difficult can it be to just find half a dozen that look the same? But
it really isn't. And especially we're in America. It's real easy. Real easy.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Hello, everybody. My name is DaVern, and I am the host of the Cinema Recall Podcast, which you can find at thatmomentin.com. On each episode, myself, along with a great guest, we will discuss in detail an iconic scene from a classic movie. So come check us out. We are available on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and most other places you can find podcasts. We are also on Facebook, just type in Cinema Recall. And we are also on Twitter at @cinema_recall. We hope you enjoy the show, and thank you for listening.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs during the climactic battle between the ape and the monster. The two monsters are duking it out against the Washington skyline. The ape appears to be in trouble, so the female Rusky scientist, who also knows how to fly an attack helicopter, pilots her Apache-style chopper straight into the mutant monster in a kamikaze death charge, whereupon the aircraft promptly explodes. Nick, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
I thought it was different because you obviously way more than me, but you and I have discussed a lot of different types and fashions in which helicopters explode on this program. just to the top four for me, tomatoes, we've seen a harpoon gun, we've seen other helicopters, and we've seen dragons destroy helicopters. Mm. But I don't think, since being on this program, I don't think I've ever seen a helicopter used in a kamikaze type way, where we're going to use the helicopter as like Chekhov's gun. It's going to be the thing that just, boom, takes out the villain, and it's going to be piloted by one of our heroes, maybe anti-heroes. We don't know. We don't have a strong enough opinion on this character. But for her to just kind of go full Nick Cage, just scream into the camera and collide with the monster, it's different. And I give them that. I give them, you know, using it as a sacrificial lamb kind of thing. I did want a bit more of an explosion, maybe a little skin tear or blood and guts from the monster. But I have to give them credit on at least being creative with this and using it as a weapon.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the fact that the Rusky goes full kamikaze, you know, suicide bomber on this kind of, as you say, this sort of screaming death charge. And, you know, I think her incredibly bad Russian accent really amps up the kind of the drama of that particular scene, because she's talking some absolute rubbish here, but you know, she's saying it in this incredibly bad Russian accent, so it kind of just somehow improves, it just somehow lifts the dialogue in that particular moment. So I really enjoyed the kind of moments leading up to it, but as you say, yeah, the actual explosion itself is not that great, and feels frankly a little bit of a letdown after you know, she kind of gives her sort of defiant final speech and then, you know, starts her death charge into the monster.
And even then, the speech must not be that stirring or important, because Linda just kind of is just okay with it. She's got tears rolling down her face, but she's not like screaming, no, don't you do this, like, how could you. There's no, I feel like, sure, in the script there seems to be some type of resolution, but I don't feel the resolution between the two. I feel like Linda's like, well, yeah, she kind of has to do this, and she's just okay with it and continues to tear. There's, I mean, she's watching it. She could have, like, there could be a moment where we don't even see the full explosion. We can see the reflection of the explosion in her eyes, right? Or if she had a helmet, a visor. We could have done something creative and fun like that. You could have really had just a big explosion and all this other excitement, but we don't. It's just like everything else. There's no payoff, and it's just kind of ho-hum.
Well, you mentioned the fact that this helicopter is used as a weapon in a kind of like suicide death charge, and you'd mentioned that you hadn't sort of seen that before, and I was racking my brains for other films where helicopters are used in that type of fashion, and there must be more of them. The only one I could think of whilst being put on the spot like that was the end of A Good Day to Die Hard, the fifth Die Hard movie, where there is again a Russian female pilot who just tries, in order to try and you know, kill off Bruce Willis and the ever irritating Jai Courtney, she just flies her big helicopter straight into this building in a kind of bid to kill them off, knowing that you know, she's going to be sort of blowing herself up in the process. So there does seem to be something oddly about female Russians who like to commit suicide in helicopters.
Maybe it's a weird fetish that is starting to kind of slowly come to the surface. I mean, you have this new Netflix show, Sexy Beasts, where they're dressing people up as furries and going on dates. Like, furry culture is becoming more and more socially acknowledged. I wouldn't say acceptable, but definitely socially acknowledged. So, you know, maybe this is like the next thing that the dark web is all about. It's like, hey, I need to hire a sexy Russian to scream while crashing a helicopter. It's like, I got you. I need $100,000 in Bitcoin.
I'm just writing that down. I'm just going to go and register sexy sexy Russian suicide helicopter.com. I'm just going to go and register that URL now. I think, yeah, and as you say, this time next year, hopefully I'll be a Bitcoin millionaire. Who knows?
Wouldn't that be something?
I'll be, you know, if it happens, Nick, I will split the money with you, because, you know, I feel, you know, you've helped originate this idea. So, yeah, if I hit the jackpot with it, yeah, you'll be sharing in the coin.
I appreciate it.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up. Nick, do you want to take a moment to tell everyone about where they can find you online?
Absolutely. You can find me on Twitter at TheRehack, T-H-E-R-E-H-A-K. And I've also kind of taken a bit of a sidestep from movies and focused more toward music. If you head over to Mixcloud.com, there's a program called Rehack Radio. That's me. I get together every Tuesday for about an hour, and I play some music. I talk about the music, and we have fun. It's trivia. It's stories. It's a whole lot of stuff. I've been having a lot of fun doing it. And like I said, it's real quick. It's an hour. It's digestible. We don't get anything crazy or egregious. So if you get a chance, check it out.
Yeah, go and give it a listen. I have done myself. And yeah, it's worth an hour of your time. So go and check that out.
Thank you.
As always, don't forget to check out our website, explodinghelicopter.com. Sharing is caring, so if you can rate, review, or retweet, we'll be very grateful, because you'll be doing us a solid. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
What the hell is DL, Blenda?
A secret joint U.S.-Soviet deep space probe launched June 17th, 1985.
Hold on, but we weren't conducting any joint missions with the Soviets back in the 80s.
That's why it's secret. April 25th, 1945, the day Soviet and American troops met at Elbe River, Germany. An important step toward ending the war.
I'm familiar with that little bit of history there, kiddo.
Well, Bush Jr. and Putin felt nostalgic.
Yeah, they determined a joint mission in a deep space. If successful, it would end the Cold War and significantly boost the economies of both countries.
And success meaning?
Contact with alien life forms.
So I'm going to presume that this mission failed.
Naturally. We lost contact with the Elbe August 12, 2007.
And contact with the ship was never reestablished?
Not until today.